Brian Udeman is a sports science professor at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse who collects things we think we know about health, diet, and exercise. Like sit-ups will make your stomach flatter and a glass of warm milk will help you sleep and how cracking your knuckles can lead to arthritis. Professor Udeman says some of these things may be true or at least have supporting evidence, but a lot of them are false. For instance, cranberry juice will not help treat urinary tract infections. And you don't have to wait an hour after eating before going swimming. Udeman collected 101 of these myths and misconceptions into a book called 25 Ways to Cure the Hiccups. That book came out a couple of years ago, and I'm guessing that he's collected a few more myths since then. I'm Jim Meadows. Brian Udeman is my guest today on Focus. We'll go over some common health myths, and we welcome any that you've collected. It's all coming up right after this hour's news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guest today, Dr. Brian Udeman, is a professor in the Department of Exercise and Sports Science and the Director of Online Education at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. His first position keeps him attuned to what people believe are the right things to do to stay healthy. His second one keeps him attuned to the Internet, where you can find an ocean of information, much of it simply not true. And so it's a combination of those two things that led to Brian's book, 26 Ways to Cure the Hiccups, Uncovering the Truth Behind 101 Common Myths and Misconceptions. He's also a speaker and a blogger on this topic. You can find his writing at this web address, Was Mom Wrong? One word, wasmomwrong.com. Dr. Udeman, welcome to Focus.
Hey, Jim. Thanks a lot. It's great to be with you.
And what you're saying from the book is a lot of the times mom was wrong.
Yeah, you know, and honestly, a lot of the times when I was telling my kids what my mom and dad told me, I was wrong as well. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, what we hear in regards to cracking our knuckles or eating after 9 p.m. and whatever it is, not going back into the lake and swimming, you know, for an hour after we eat, many times that makes sense. But most people don't actually dive into kind of the published scientific literature, the research on the topic, and sometimes the advice that we've been given and the advice that we've given our kids isn't totally correct.
Well, what led you to start researching this stuff seriously to find out what the answers were?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've taught health and wellness courses on college campuses for the last 20-plus years, and at one point, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, I started incorporating some of these myth questions into my lectures. So if I talked about cardiovascular health or resistance training, flexibility, body image, didn't matter what it was, I started to throw in some of these myths, and the students, I found, really liked it. They laughed, they learned things, they thought it was informative, they made fun of their parents because, you know, sometimes they told them things that were incorrect. And one day after class, one of my students came up, well, even before that, then I decided to put together a standalone lecture just on health myths and misconceptions. So I had maybe 25 or 30 of them, and then I did an entire lecture just on health myths. And at the end of that semester, I asked the students of the 20 or 25 lectures they had in class and topics that were covered, which they liked the most, and probably 95% of them said, you know, the one on health myths, that was great. And at one point, a student came up to me after a class and said, that was really, really interesting. You should write a book on health myths and misconceptions. So, you know, I took that advice to heart, and I wrote the book, and it came out, like you said, a year and a half or a couple years ago.
Well, if you folks know of any surefire cures, claims are just factoids about health, exercise, diet, and nutrition. Maybe it's one that Brian Udeman knows about or should know about. So give us a call at 333-9455 or toll free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL and toll free 1-800-222-WILL. And you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus, numbers 580. I wanted to ask, let's start with the title, because you do in the introduction include 25 ways to cure the hiccups. Do they work? Do we know anything about what works with the hiccups?
Yeah, that's another good question. When we were coming up with the title of the book, we had three or four possible titles, and then this was one of them, and I shared it with lots of people, and they really enjoyed it. So I actually dug into the literature a little bit, could not find one scientific, peer-reviewed, published article on ways to get rid of the hiccups. Now, if you have someone who has chronic hiccups and they have to go to the doctor, you know they've had them for 24 hours or 48 hours, there's certainly medications that are available to help reduce the hiccups or stop the hiccups in that case. But kind of the things that you hear people talk about, standing on your head and drinking a glass of water, holding your breath, having someone scare you, you know, all of the things that we hear about, I honestly, you know, eating sugar, I couldn't find one published study that has looked at these different types of cures for hiccups and whether or not they're effective. So, and it's still, I still haven't been able to find one.
So some of these things may work?
Oh, absolutely. So there's a reason why many of the things, if you talk to people, they'll have, you know, what they think is their absolute cure, whether it is drinking a glass of water, taking in some sugar, you know, having a teaspoon of sugar, holding your breath. One that I hear from people a lot is eating a teaspoon or a tablespoon of peanut butter. And one of the reasons, there's a couple of reasons why some of those things might work. One of the reasons is one of the cranial nerves that's activated when you actually have the hiccup. So you have this consistent nervous signal that's going from your brain down to your diaphragm, and that's that rhythmic contraction that causes the hiccups. Well, one of the cranial nerves passes kind of close to the surface on the back of your throat. So if you can hold your breath, if you swallow water, if you eat something, you could somehow possibly, the thought is, disrupt that signal from your brain to your diaphragm, and you could kind of knock out the hiccups. And many times, if you do nothing, hiccups will go away in 30 seconds, 45 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. Usually they don't last that long. So maybe there's just some connection there, too, of doing something, and you know the resolution of the hiccups would happen anyway.
Let me look at some of the ones that I mentioned at the beginning of the program. Some myths in your book, such as sit-ups will make your stomach flatter. Not true?
Not true. So sit-ups are great for you. You know, different types of abdominal exercises, crunches, sit-ups. But those activities and exercises can certainly tone and firm and strengthen the muscles within your abdomen region. But I've seen studies where, you know, researchers have taken research participants and have had them do hundreds, if not thousands, of sit-ups over the course of maybe 5 or 7 or 10 weeks, and they measured body fat on top of the sit-ups, and they've taken pictures, and they've looked at the appearance of the abdominal area, and nothing really changes. So, you know, if you're really interested in leaning up your midsection, kind of trying to get that six-pack, or maybe if we're a little older, we'd be happy with a four-pack, you know, what you got to do is, certainly the exercising is good, but try and lose some of the fat that's on top. So a little more cardiovascular exercise, maybe reducing your caloric intake just a bit. If you can decrease your body fat percentage by 1 or 2 or 3 or 4%, depending upon where you're starting, then certainly that would have a bigger impact at changing the appearance of your midsection than just doing sit-ups.
Another one I mentioned, a glass of warm milk will help you sleep.
Yep, really no research to back that up, and for many people, including myself, it can actually have the opposite effects. I think I was in my early 20s when I first tried that, and I think my mom may have tried it with me when I was very, very young, but I was having trouble sleeping one night, and you know, I had a glass of milk, and for me, it was actually, I didn't like it. It just didn't sit well with me, and I'm someone who really likes milk, but again, really nothing in the literature to back that up. The thinking is there's a little bit of tryptophan in milk, so if you drink that, it could cause drowsiness and help you fall asleep, just like there's a little bit of tryptophan in turkey, and people think that causes drowsiness as well. But the truth is, there's not enough tryptophan either in milk or turkey, unless you had a lot of milk or a lot of turkey, to have any impact on drowsiness at all.
Could it possibly be in the right context that a glass of milk has a placebo effect, depending on perhaps who was giving you the glass of warm milk?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, many of these things, there can be a placebo effect there, whether it relates to exercise or nutrition or, you know, in this case, the glass of milk. And for some people, it might be that it's warm, it's soothing. You know, if people truly believe that there will be a calming effect or a drowsiness effect to it, that could be positive as well. But again, if you kind of take a step back and look at the peer-reviewed scientific literature, there's really nothing out there that says drinking warm milk before going to bed, for most people, will cause them to be drowsy and sleep better.
I know one that I heard when I was a kid taking piano lessons. I heard it from one of my fellow students about cracking your knuckles leading to arthritis.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. And so there's been studies, some long-term studies on crackers versus non-crackers, and there's really no support in the published studies that show those individuals who crack their knuckles consistently, even over a long period of time, have any higher rates of arthritis or increased size of their knuckles. I just read something maybe 3 or 4 months ago about a physician who did kind of a study on himself. It wasn't a scientific study, but it said for a period of many years, like 40 or 45 years, he cracked the knuckles on one hand, but he didn't on the other. And he did that on a daily basis. And no difference at all in regards to him having pain or arthritis in the hand or enlarged joints where he was cracking his knuckles.
We have one coming in on email from Mike. Mike wants to know if you know whether stretching before running or other exercise helps prevent injury. He's particularly interested in relation to strength training.
Yeah, so there's really a big body of knowledge or research on stretching. And really there's two parts to the stretching. Or two components that people usually look at. One, does stretching help improve performance? And two, does stretching help decrease injury rates? And generally, people are very surprised by this, but this is very clear in the research literature that if you stretch before activity, it has very little impact on your performance and it has very little impact on injury rates. Now, it is clearly proven that if you do static stretching before activities that require explosive type movements or efforts, like sprinting or jumping up to get a rebound in basketball, if you do static stretching, kind of what we normally think of as stretching, prior to those activities, you will actually see a decrease in your performance of 2 or 3 or 4%. And the reason for that is as you stretch your muscles out, when you're done stretching, they don't come back together. You know, there's some elasticity there, and they don't end up very quickly where they started out. And it's that tautness or that tension that can contribute to explosive movements in performance. Now, stretching is not bad. Static stretching is not bad. What most exercise science and fitness experts now recommend is that you do the static stretching after your activity. So if you do static stretching consistently when you're done with practice, when you're done with your runs, when you're done with lifting, you can increase or improve your flexibility by maybe 2 or 3 or 4%. That can have a positive impact on performance, and that can even have a positive impact on injury rates, probably a small impact. But doing it before, not necessarily. Now, that's static stretching. So what most experts now recommend before activity, whether it's resistance training or cardiovascular exercise, you know, soccer practice, basketball, baseball, football, whatever, is that you go through some type of active or dynamic stretching and warm-up. Many people recommend that you start with just 5 or 10 minutes of a light jog, get your sweat going, increase your temperature. That certainly helps. And then go through and do some movement-type stretches, again, active or dynamic stretching, but not that static stretching before activity.
So the new rule of thumb should be that sort of active stretching where your body's really moving a little bit before you do a bout of exercise.
Yep, correct.
And then save the static stretching for afterwards.
That's correct.
Okay. We are talking with Professor Brian Udeman of the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse, and he is an expert about myths surrounding exercise, diet, and health. And we're going over some of them today, including a few that may be true. If you have a health myth to tell us about, true or not, call us at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. You can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. And the phone number again, 333-WYLL, 1-800-222-WYLL. And on social media, Twitter or Facebook, we're at Focus 580. And we had one question that came in from Jan, which she attributes to, quote, my group of wild friends when we were teenagers. Is this little rhyme true? Beer before whiskey, very risky. Whiskey before beer, never fear.
Yeah, I knew where you were going with that one when I heard younger and teenager, and that's really not true. You know, one reiteration of that is beer before liquor, get sick quicker, liquor before beer, never fear. And I've not, and I've actually looked at that and dug into it a little bit, have not been able to find any support whatsoever in regards to the different types of alcohol that you're drinking and the order that you drink them. Basically, it really comes down to how much you've taken in. Doesn't matter if it's beer first or liquor first. Comes down to the total amount.
Okay, and usually the way they're measured, I've always gotten the impression that a glass of beer and a shot of whiskey, for instance, has a similar amount of alcohol. One just has a lot more water.
Yeah, it's actually, you really have to pay attention to, you know, when we talk about alcohol, and I preach moderation usually when I do my speaking, and for women, you know, it's really recommended that they consume, if they're going to consume alcohol, that moderation is one drink a day. Men, a little larger on average, 1 to 2 drinks a day. But pay attention to how much is in a drink. So with beer, it's about 12 ounces. With wine, it's 4 or 4.5, maybe 5 ounces. And hard liquor, it's 1.5 ounces. But you're getting roughly about the same amount of alcohol in a serving, whether it's beer, liquor, or wine.
And is that in your book about the difference between men and women in alcohol intake?
Yeah, so there's a chapter in there about whether or not men can tolerate or handle alcohol more than women or better than women. And a couple things there. Again, one, men are bigger. Men generally have a little more muscle mass than women, and there's a little more water in muscle than there is compared to fat. So with the increased size, the alcohol can dissipate a little bit better. With the increased amount of water that men have in their body, usually about 60 to 65% versus 50 to 55% for women, you know, that alcohol can actually be absorbed into that water, and they can handle that a little bit better. But the primary reason is men have much more alcohol dehydrogenase, an enzyme that almost immediately starts to act on or to break down to oxidize alcohol. So that's the primary reason. Men will have anywhere from 40 to 50, even 60% more ADH or alcohol dehydrogenase than women, and that's the primary reason.
So even though there are small men and big women who might change the equation on that part of it, the other two factors that you mentioned are pretty much the case for men versus women.
Yep, that's correct. So if you take body weight or body size as a factor there, that ADH, that alcohol dehydrogenase, is really one of the primary reasons.
Okay. Another thing I believe I mentioned at the beginning of the program, chocolate can hurt or even kill your dog.
Yep. There's a chemical in chocolate called theobromine, and that is very dangerous to dogs, especially if you get into kind of the baker's chocolate or the dark chocolates. So you know, I have a small dog. I've had dogs my whole life. Every once in a while, they'll you know, I'll drop a peanut M&M, and they'll run over there and get it and eat it. And you know, generally, I won't panic. But if a dog would get into a big chunk of, you know, dark chocolate or unsweetened baker's chocolate type thing, then that's pretty serious, and you probably want to get them to a vet.
Would a dog find unsweetened baker's chocolate that appetizing?
You know, I've never tried it, but the dogs that I've owned eat almost everything that falls on the floor, so maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't.
Now, that's interesting that dogs should have a particular problem with chocolate. Do other pets have problems with chocolate?
To my knowledge, they don't. This came up on a previous show I was on months ago, and to my knowledge, they don't. But for whatever reason, this theobromine really impacts the nervous system of dogs, and that's why it can be so dangerous.
So if your cat wants to eat a Milky Way bar, it's okay.
Yeah, I would say check with your vet, but I've never heard that it's a problem for cats.
Okay. One particular thing that struck me, because it's something that everybody uses, certainly where we work here at WILL, cell phones and the possibility of them causing brain tumors.
Yeah, you know, generally when it comes to these health myths and misconceptions and things that impact our health, I'm not, you know, a real alarmist, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist type person. But this is one that I've been paying attention to probably pretty closely for the last 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years. And we're just getting to the point now, Jim, where we have kind of data that has looked at heavy cell phone users and people who have been doing that for 10 or 11 or 12 years. So, and again, don't want to, like, you know, ring any huge alarm bells, but I have a cell phone, my kids have cell phones, but I just think we're at the point now where we're starting to see some evidence of people, again, heavy users, so who use their cell phones a lot, and they've been doing it for a long time, 8 or 10 or 12 years. And if, especially, they always hold their cell phone on one side of their head, so it's always on the left side, always on the right side, starting to see a slight increase in a couple different types of brain tumors in those folks. So, you know, you start to see more people now. Well, some cell phones are sold. States are requiring that there are actually warning labels on the cell phones or the boxes that they come in. And you see more and more people now with the wireless sets. So they're carrying their cell phone someplace, but they have the wireless ear piece. And that's to keep that cell phone away from their head. So.
Well, I'm wondering, with the data we have now, what sort of percentage of heavy cell phone users, and I'm going to ask you for the definition of heavy use as well, but what sort of percentage are we seeing between use and tumors?
It's very small. And I can't give you a specific percent, but again, the risk of cancer and people who are using cell phones and using them heavily. So the definition of heavy maybe is somewhere between 3 and 5 hours a day, which sounds like a lot for people, but you know, you get younger kids, they're 15, 18, 20, even some folks who are a little bit older tend to use it a lot. So again, I can't give you any specifics there in increased risks or percentages, but it's not a lot. But the data that's starting to kind of tease itself out now shows a very slight increase in those brain tumors.
Now, I'm wondering, with a controversial subject like this one, when you talk about this and the talks that you give are in classes for college kids, do you ever get pushback from people who just don't believe you?
Oh, sure. You know, I did a presentation yesterday, and one that I talk about that's actually in the book is, you know, if you give kids sugar, it leads to them being more hyper.
Then that's when I thought, well, sure.
Yeah, and you know, honestly, it's not true. There's, again, according to the data that's out there. So there's probably been a dozen studies that I've looked at that where researchers have given children sugar, and they get them in big groups or a couple different groups, and they watch them. They'll give, you know, a group of kids sugar and a group of kids a placebo where they think they're eating candy or cake or cookies or soda, and there's no sugar in it. And then they just watch their activity levels. And really, there's no difference whatsoever. That's pretty crystal clear in the literature. So people generally have never gone out and looked at or reviewed or read those type of research articles, but they'll have experience from birthday parties or their children or whatnot. And, you know, my wife and I have 3 kids. They're 14, 11, and 9, and I can tell you that we've had dozens and dozens and dozens of birthday parties, and, you know, we give our kids, you know, cake and cookies and soda and those types of things. And it's something I paid attention to. When you get 10 kids together for a party, it doesn't matter if you've given them cake or soda. You know, they're really pretty active and pretty crazy. And so it really isn't true, but sometimes people make that connection. Oh, it's a party, there's a birthday cake, and, you know, there's this increased activity levels. I did a quick experiment with my kids. This has been a few years ago now. It's not scientific by any means, but after trick-or-treating one year, we went home. I dumped all the candy on the floor and said, guys, go ahead, go crazy. You have 20 minutes. Eat as much as you want. And they looked at me like I was, you know, a little crazy, and they didn't believe me at first, and I said, no, really, go ahead. So they did. They ate as much candy as they wanted. When they were done, I said, head upstairs, brush your teeth, go to bed. They did it. They fell asleep just like they did the night before.
Okay, so that one, so you could feed kids porridge at a birthday party. They might be a little disappointed, but
that's,
you think,
right?
They might be as hyper as always.
Yeah, I guess my point is there, you know, someone challenged me on that. And many times people just have this thinking that they've had for many years. Here's another great example. People think that when there's a full moon, you know, our behavior starts to go a little crazy, and we tend to do really dumb things, and you know, admittances into emergency rooms or emergency departments go way up. People get arrested more at higher rates during times when there's a full moon. But if you really dig into the data from emergency rooms or from police stations, there's no difference whatsoever, of being hurt and going to the hospital or being arrested when there's a full moon. But say you have a nurse who works in a hospital, and one night when there was a full moon, you had two or three really crazy things that happened, and all of a sudden there's this, strong association. Or even if you don't have work experience related to that, if that's just something that you believe, then when you see that happen on occasion, it really kind of reinforces that in your brain, even though that's not what kind of the published research shows, which most people, again, don't go out and actually look at.
Well, it's time for a short break here on Focus, and we'll be back in a moment with more health and nutrition myths with Professor Brian Udeman. We'll be taking a look in particular at some exercise myths after we come back. This is Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows. We're back on Focus with Professor Brian Udeman of the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, and Brian is the author of 26 Ways to Cure the Hiccups, Uncovering the Truth Behind 101 Common Myths and Misconceptions. And he blogs about those myths and misconceptions at the website wasmomwrong.com. And we'd love to hear from you about your health and exercise myths. Whatever you believe, some of it may actually be true. Maybe Brian can help us with that. Call us at 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. The phone number again, 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. I wanted to go back to specifically some myths about exercise. That's one of the categories in your book, and we've already covered one from a listener about stretching before and after, and I realized that all the static stretching that I did before running, it was wasted. Is that what you're telling me? Wasted?
Yeah, with the cardiovascular exercise, it's not as detrimental as with the explosive type movements, the sprinting or the jumping. So that's really kind of the primary area where the experts say if you're going to do the static stretching and you're going to do explosive type movements, do it at the end. And I would recommend it, as someone who's been in health and fitness for the last 20 years, if you're going to do, light cardiovascular exercise, you're going to go for a walk or you're going to go out for a jog, that's not as big of a deal. So certainly, if you really like to, you really want to, you could do the static stretching beforehand. But again, it's not going to improve performance. Most of the studies show that it's not going to decrease your rate of injury just because you do it right before. Again, if you do it after, you do improve your flexibility. That, in the long run, does improve performance and may have an impact on decreasing injury rates. So I wouldn't say you wasted all that time because, maybe doing it before you did see some improvement in your flexibility. But and this is different, Nick, when I grew up, and I'm in my 40s, and that's all we did was static stretching before exercise or before activity. And many times now with my kids and their youth sports, they're coached by folks like me, my age, and so they're still doing the same thing. So this is slowly making its way, even though it's been pretty clear in the research over the last 5 to 10 years about static stretching prior to activity. It still kind of takes some time to trickle down to all the college teams and the high school teams and the junior high teams or middle school teams, as well as the youth sports.
And Brian, I've just been noted by my producer and also by Jason and at the controls that I just called your book 26 Ways to Cure the Hiccups, which is not going to help anyone trying to look your book up on Amazon right now. So let me tell you, it's 25 ways to cure the hiccups.
Yeah, thank you.
That's all you were able to find, 25.
Yep. Well, no, honestly, if you Google cures for hiccups, you'll come up with hundreds, if not thousands. So I pulled out what I thought were 25 very interesting cures for hiccups, and those are actually listed in the first part of the book.
Well, back to the exercise myths. Morning workouts elevate metabolism more than evening workouts.
Yeah,
not true.
That is not true at all. And I hear this one a lot from people, and I think the reasoning there, or the thinking, or what some people have been told, is you wake up in the morning, you exercise, you increase your metabolism, and then you're active for the rest of the day, so your metabolism stays elevated for the rest of the day. And it's really not true. You could. We actually did a study here at UW-La Crosse maybe 5 or 6 years ago where we brought people into our human performance lab. We had them exercise at 5 o'clock in the morning, at noon, and at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and we actually measured the amount of oxygen that they consumed, the amount of carbon dioxide they put off, and how many calories they burned. Absolutely no difference in the number of calories burned depending upon what time of day you exercise. And it's not like your metabolism will elevate a small amount after you exercise, during exercise, and then afterwards. But that's no difference, and it's really no different if you exercise at 5 in the morning or at 10 o'clock at night. So if you exercise at night at 9 or 10 o'clock and then you go to bed, you're still going to burn the same number of calories after your workout than if you did it at 5 o'clock in the morning. So
does it matter if you exercise close to mealtime, for instance?
No, it really doesn't. And again, you know, what I tell people is find things that you like doing, that you will do, and then stick with those things. But some people get up in the morning at 4 or 5 o'clock and exercise because they think they're going to burn more calories and it's actually better for them. And this is another interesting point about early exercising or late exercising. You know, it's pretty crystal clear from, again, the research that we can perform better later on in the day. When you get up in the morning, your temperature is generally a little bit lower. You don't feel real good, like you really want to get out, you know, and attack something, like if you're going to go do a strong workout. So the studies that I've looked at, like our maximum strength or maximum performance on cardiovascular tests, you know, like a graded exercise test, generally, most people perform better at 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 in the afternoon than they do at 5 or 6 or 7 in the morning.
Another myth, the soreness you feel after exercise is due to lactic acid buildup. I know I was told this. It sounds sensible, but no.
Yeah, it's really not. So this is another one that probably the thinking on this has changed maybe over the last 10 to 15 years. We've known this for quite a while. So that soreness is called DOMS, D-O-M-S, delayed onset muscle soreness, and that's that soreness you feel maybe 12 or 24 or 48 hours after you exercise. Your muscles are kind of achy, and sometimes if you overdo it, it can actually be painful. And the thinking was that it's the lactic acid, just a normal byproduct of exercise, and it does increase as you get to be doing more intense type exercise. You'll generate or produce, your body will, a little bit more lactic acid or higher levels of lactic acid. So the thought was it was that lactic acid that causes the soreness. And what scientists now know is it's really damage in your muscles when you do resistance training or if you're doing downhill running, you know, it really strains your hamstrings. And what you do is you just create hundreds and thousands and maybe even hundreds of thousands of small little tiny micro tears in your muscle. So really that soreness comes from muscle damage. And again, very small at the microscopic level, but every one of those small little tears has a very small little inflammatory reaction that occurs as those small little tears heal and, you know, recuperate. So that's where that soreness comes from. It actually comes from damaging your muscles. And we think about it, especially resistance training, that's what you're doing. You're lifting heavy weights, you know, the eccentric, usually that second phase of the contraction where your muscle is lengthening, you're holding that weight and you're going through your full range of motion, but you're getting small little tears in your muscle that your body over the next 24 or 48 hours actually repairs. But that's where that soreness comes from.
Those micro tears, are they part of the muscle building process or just a side effect?
No. Absolutely. They are part of the muscle building process. So especially when you do that resistance training, when you lift and you kind of break your muscles down, it rebuilds itself. So it's just a tiny bit bigger and a tiny bit stronger the next time. It's not real easy to add muscle. People think, I'm just going to start lifting weights and I'm going to get huge. It's pretty hard. You really have to, you know, stress yourself and keep progressing in regards to what you're doing, in regards to weight, and certainly do it safely, but that's how your muscles get bigger, and that's how you get stronger. Your muscles break down, your body rebuilds that musculature or that damage, And slowly over time, you get a little bit bigger and you get a little bit stronger. So that's why it's important to rest in between. You know, if you do a chest workout or a back workout, you don't want to, and it's pretty tough, you don't want to do that the next day. Give your body time to recuperate. That's also why it's important. You know, if you really look at high-level power lifters or high-level weightlifters, bodybuilders, boy, they really, you know, they get enough rest, they get enough recuperation, they really focus on their nutrition to give their body, you know, the carbohydrates they need to replenish their cells, the protein that they need to help rebuild their musculature. All of that is important.
Okay, another myth there under the area of exercise and fitness, exercising on a regular basis will make you live longer.
Yep. You know, good science here. When I was
this one is true. You
this say. One is true. That is correct. And when I was kind of growing up, and I got into college early on, years and years ago, I would hear people say that for every minute that you exercise, you add a minute to your life. And if you take someone who's maybe 20 or I did the math a long time ago, someone who's 20 or 25 and they exercise, say, 30 minutes three times a week over the course of their lifetime, and then they're 70 or 80, you know, that will probably add up to about that same number of minutes, you know, the number of minutes total that are in a year. But the research that's out there shows that if you're doing light to moderate exercise, so things like walking on a consistent basis, gardening, yard work, you know, going out for bicycle rides, but they're not super intense, generally you'll add 1 to 2 years to your life, of good years to your life. And if you're someone who does a little bit more intense exercise, so moderate intensity up to high intensity exercise, so whether that is running or swimming at a little higher intensity level, then that you can bump that a little bit. Research shows more like 3 or 4 years. But yes, that is true.
Okay, the number to call is 333-9455, or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. I'm going to go to line one for Ron in Decatur with something to say about Charlie horses.
Yeah, the older I get, the more Charlie horses I seem to get, and the common remedy, at least folklore, is you take some potassium pills. Any comments about Charlie horses and what can you do or whatever?
Yeah, that's interesting. I did a presentation one time, and someone afterwards said, my mom always used to put a bar of soap under my mattress, and that's supposed to get rid of the Charlie horses. I don't know if you've ever heard that. But one of the primary causes for Charlie horses or cramps or spasms in our musculature is just dehydration and lack of fluids. So my kids have these sometimes. Every once in a while, I'll get them. And I talk to people a lot who, you know, struggle with Charlie horses a little bit. And if they simply increase their water intake, maybe eat more fruits and vegetables, they're full of water. Most of the time, their symptoms, the Charlie horses, the cramps, the spasms that they have many times at night, whether it's in your calf or whether it's in your hamstring, and those can be incredibly painful. They'll go. I mean, they can wake you up and make you scream in the middle of the night. Yeah. And it's not a bad idea if you don't do any stretching at all to do some of that static stretching that we talked about before, just a little bit. Or there's different types of dynamic or active warm-ups or stretching that you can do as well. Sometimes that will have a positive impact at decreasing the number of Charlie horses that you have. So maybe try that. But the water, I think the water is really the key. And you could do things like try and take salt pills or potassium pills or drink pickle juice and whatnot. But for most people, just increasing their fluid intake, water, fruits and vegetables, things like that, has a positive impact.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much, Ron. Let's go over to line two. David in Urbana, you're on the air on Focus.
Thank you. Well, what is the truth about aluminum cookware?
Yeah, there's a chapter in the book about aluminum cookware and whether or not it contributes to Alzheimer's. So the thought process here is that if you look at the brain cells of people with Alzheimer's disease, that they have increased rates of aluminum. But medical professionals, scientific professionals are all in agreement that there's not a connection between the aluminum that are in cooking pots and the aluminum that is shown or that has built up in the brain cells of people with Alzheimer's. Aluminum, I believe, is the third most abundant element on Earth. So there's aluminum in a lot of things. the amount of aluminum that is included or has been included or has been in, like, cooking pots and pans and whatnot is very, very, very small. So if you look at the research, the well-done, well-controlled, published research, there's really no connection there between aluminum pots and cooking and then folks with Alzheimer's having increased rates of aluminum in their brain cells.
Well, that's reassuring.
All right. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much. And that is, I'm wondering then the elevated aluminum amounts that are found in the brain cells of people with Alzheimer's, do we know how it got there or what role it plays in the onset of Alzheimer's?
No. Researchers and medical professionals, physicians are still trying to figure that one out.
Okay. I was looking also at some nutrition myths you mentioned in the book. And one of them is one I've certainly heard over the years, that vitamin C helps prevent colds. And I know that this was something that was championed by the late Nobel laureate Linus Pauling when he was alive.
That is correct. So I'm not sure if it was the 60s or the 70s, but a couple of the early studies, they weren't well done, that came out looking at vitamin C and whether or not it can help prevent you from getting a cold, showed that there was some positive effect there. And Linus Pauling, I believe, actually put that in a book, and it really caught on. There was some popularity there, and people started to see that and believe that. Since then, there have been hundreds, I would probably say thousands of studies that have looked at vitamin C. Most of them say there's no impact, there's no link between taking vitamin C and preventing you from catching a cold. Now, there's a little bit of evidence that shows that if you're someone who is under extreme cold or physical stress, so that's, again, not most of us, but maybe you're in the military or you're doing extreme sports or whatever it is, for individuals who are potentially under extreme cold or physical stress, taking vitamin C might have a small impact. And whether it's vitamin C or zinc or echinacea or many of the other things that you can buy, for the most part, they might cause you to have signs and symptoms maybe for a day or two less than if you didn't take those. And generally, most of them are safe. They're not super expensive. I really don't take any of those things when I get a cold. So if I have signs and symptoms for 9 days versus 8 days or 7 days, I think it's worth saving the $5 or the $10 or the $15. But for the most part, most of the evidence out there shows really no association or relationship between taking vitamin C and decreasing your risk for catching a cold.
Or taking anything else and decreasing the risk or the duration of a cold. But
yeah.
I think you said something in the book about chicken soup.
Yeah, that's a great one, and that's actually true. So, you know,
but not necessarily about colds?
It's true for colds. If you have not catching a cold, but if you have a cold, and you eat chicken soup, once or twice a day for 3 or 4 or 5 days, that can help you get rid of a cold. And pretty interesting research on this. It doesn't necessarily matter if it's homemade chicken soup or if it's store-bought chicken soup. I saw one study that looked at maybe 8 or 10 different brands of chicken soup. And, you know, one of the factors here is there's eating chicken soup, well, there could be a lot of different things. One, it's warm. Two, it could be the steam you're taking in. Three, it could be the liquids, just some nutrients from the vegetables and the noodles and the soup. So lots of different things. But there, potentially, the thought is there's a kind of an anti-inflammatory effect from the chicken soup that helps you recover quicker from the common cold.
Okay. And I was thinking of I know when I have colds, I'll sometimes take chicken soup, and then I'll doctor it up with things like pepper and onion powders and things. And my assumption was always, well, this isn't really going to speed things up, but it feels good going down.
Yeah, and it actually does. And, with chicken soup, there's electrolytes in there, so that, some sodium and some potassium, so that could potentially have a slight positive effect on decreasing your signs and symptoms sooner.
You don't think putting vitamin C or echinacea into the chicken soup would make much of a difference?
No, not unless you're under extreme physical or cold stress.
Okay. Now, earlier we were talking with a listener who called in with a question about Charlie horses, and you counseled more fluids. And that runs up against, or maybe just dovetails with another entry in the book about how much water we need to have every day. And do we need 8 glasses of water a day?
Yep. So the general thinking there and what we hear often is, you know, 8 glasses, 8 ounces a glass, so 64 ounces of water. And you see people walking around, and that's not bad. If you want to drink 60 or 70 or 80 ounces of water, you can certainly do that. No, you can drink too much water, and we could talk about that a little bit later on. But you don't necessarily have to consume 64 ounces of water a day. So the Institute of Medicine now recommends that we consume somewhere between 70 and 100 ounces of fluid a day. So women, on average, a little bit smaller, maybe 70 to 80 ounces. Men, on average, a little bit bigger, maybe 90 to 100 ounces. But that could come from anything. So, you know,
how much fluid just comes from eating?
Yeah, that's, you know, it depends upon what you're eating. Again, I mentioned this before, but fruits and vegetables, they're almost 100% water. So if you're eating a lot of fruits and vegetables, the water content from the food that you eat, and even if it's, you know, more than fruits and vegetables, count in that fluid recommendation of 70 to 100 ounces. But, and it doesn't necessarily just need to be water. It could be coffee. It could be tea. It could be juice. It could be soda, you know, it could be milk, it could be even liquor. Most, you know, liquor is primarily water, so it's the total fluid amount that you're taking in. So some people think, well, you know, I'm drinking something like coffee, and there's caffeine in there, there's a diuretic effect, you know, cause fluids to be flushed from my system. But that diuretic effect from coffee is pretty small. So I drink a lot of coffee, I might drink 50 ounces a day, there's caffeine in there, there's a diuretic effect, but the diuretic effect from the coffee that I drink in would maybe make me lose about 10 ounces of fluid. So I drink 50, I'm losing 10 or maybe 15. I'm still at a positive net gain of fluid intake of 35 or 40 ounces.
And in connection with our earlier question, the beer before whiskey question, you do have a myth here. Beer in moderation is good for you. True or false?
Yeah, I love talking about that one. It's true, and it's alcohol in general. So whether it's wine, red or white, liquor or beer, and there's really
is it the alcohol or is it something in the drink?
Yeah, no, it's the alcohol. So, and the key there too is moderation. So people who consume alcohol in moderation can increase their good cholesterol levels. That HDL can decrease their bad cholesterol levels. That LDL, and there's an enzyme in alcohol that could have a potential thinning effect on your blood, a slight thinning effect, so you have less things like clots and aneurysms and strokes and whatnot. And this one is very well studied by some big, you know, governmentally funded NIH-type studies. But if you're looking just at cardiovascular disease, anywhere from a 20 to 30, even 40% reduction in risk for cardiovascular disease in those individuals who consume alcohol in moderation. And again, that moderation is the key, because if you go beyond that, then you increase your risk for cardiovascular disease from drinking. And if you look at other things, alcohol is, I've said this a couple of times now, but alcohol is another topic. There's just literally thousands of research studies that have been done and published on alcohol, and there's a lot of benefits to consuming alcohol in moderation. One example is if you look at cognitive functioning, our ability to think and process and reason and problem solve as we get older is actually better or higher in individuals who consume alcohol in moderation. But again, the amount that you take in is really key.
Are we still making more myths about health? Are these things that you find still forming? Are we just working over the old ones? I mean,
So I have a second book that I'm working on. I'm about halfway done with that.
And how much material have you gathered there?
You know, I have another 101, and I've got about 50 of them done. And I have about another 150 on top of that for a third book ready to go. And so it's sometimes it's the old myths and ideas that are being rehashed, but at other times, it's new. I just maybe, I don't know, a month or two ago, I wrote a chapter in the new book about whether or not bicycling could lead to impotence or erectile dysfunction in men. And, you know, that's something that we didn't hear from our mothers or whatnot, but it's pretty important, especially for those guys and gals and individuals who go out and they ride their bikes a lot. And it really is true, depending upon the amount that you go out and you're on your bike, especially, you know, I'm talking about men here, but If you're on your cycle a lot, you could potentially have problems with erectile dysfunction or impotence. So, you know, there certainly are always new topics that are coming out, but things like, you know, milk makes you phlegmy. That's a chapter in my next book. That's actually false, but that's been around for a long time. Then you get some interesting things like brown eggs are healthier than white eggs. You know, that's something that we've just kind of heard of maybe not for the
true last or false
40 or 50 years. That's false. So brown eggs, if you look at the nutritional components of brown eggs and white eggs and the nutritional makeup, whether it's, you know, protein or whatever it is, they're virtually exactly the same. So here's another one that was somewhat recent. And some of these actually come from things that, as you mentioned earlier in the show, that are floating around on the internet. Antiperspirants increase the risk of breast cancer. That one's false. That maybe came out and floated around the internet, I don't know, 8 or 10 years ago. So the thought was that you put antiperspirant on under your armpits and you can't sweat as much or get rid of toxins, so that increases your risk of getting breast cancer, and that's not true.
Okay, well, we are just about out of time. Brian Uterman, thank you very much for being on the show today. Brian is with the University of Wisconsin at La Crosse. He's written one book and is working on more about myths in health, nutrition, diet, and exercise. Go to his website, wasmomwrong.com. Brian, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thanks, Jim. It was great being with you.
I'll be off next week. Chris Berube steps in on Monday for our show about women in bluegrass music. This is Focus on WILL.